Welcome to Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. I'm Kuma, and I'm going to talk to you about trains. Now, this time around, I'm not going to really talk about a legend or a myth, but I am going to tell a story. Well, anecdotes, if nothing else. Now, on this program in the past, and oh my God, we'll probably do this for as long as my voice holds out, talk about what makes trains go. I mean, the first trains were hopper wagons or little flat cars or things pulled by people or by horses or donkeys or whatever. And they'd be little carts similar to the one that I have a picture of on the photo gallery. That's the one with the sort of funny looking wheels that sort of are narrow in the middle so they stay on top of log type rails. Anyhow, they were little small wagons for carrying ore from mines and such quarries and that kind of thing. All right, so before we ever even had steam locomotives, we had trains. Well, an interesting thing, we'll go off on a sort of step here. Remember, people have had wagons of some sort pulled by draft animals, horses, donkeys, oxen, humans. These wagons have been around for how many millennia that we don't know about. I am not going to try to quote that. But here's one of the gist I'm going to make. Early on, and there are examples going back 1,000 years or more, that these wagons had one little problem in that they were much easier to pull the heavy load in a wagon than it was to pull it, well, by carrying the sacks of grain, the sacks of dirt, the sacks of big chunks of rock. Obviously, a wagon was a lot easier to move. And sometimes, and quite often, if maybe the wagon was going downhill, you wanted to make it go slower. Well, you needed some kind of a brake. Now, I remember a picture of wagons in the American West, the 1820s, 1840s, something like that. Anyway, there was the people had actually put a stick, I mean a large, not a stick, but like a small log, between the axles of their two wheels and roped it there. So the wheels couldn't even turn, so that it dragged its way down a hill to make sure it wouldn't go too fast. I mean, that's pretty darn extreme form of a brake, but a brake nonetheless. Well, as wagon and carts and stagecoaches and carriage technology improved, I mean, people had carriages in the 12th and the 15th century and the 16th century. I mean, wagons had been around and carriages had been around for a while. And most of these had brakes. Now, the brakes were really quite simple. Often, they might even only work on one wheel, or you might have, you know, a driver and an assistant, and they both press on a brake. It was simply a lever mounted to the body of the coach or the wagon. And it was in the middle of the, well, not the middle, it might be one direction or the other, but a pivot point, and you pushed on the lever, and the other end of the lever would push against the brake, you know, against the wheel. Now, sometimes you'd put a shoe, you know, on a piece of wood that was curve-shaped so that it would make very good contact with the wheel. And you'd push on this, and it would rub really hard, and it would slow the wagon down, or very importantly, make the wagon stop. And you might have seen this with a big lever that the fellow on a stagecoach reached out with his foot and shoves down on this lever, and it stops the wagon. Well, that's very helpful and make the horses not really want to go anywhere when it's really hard to pull. So that's good for stopping and sitting there. Now, what has all this got to do with trains, Kuma? Wagon is a wagon, whether it's on a dirt road or a railroad. Except, railroads have that one thing that we all have talked about here before, and I will bring it up over and again. It's called I won't use a fancy term. The simple term is, it's much easier to pull a wagon on a railroad. It's much easier to drive your car on a nice, smooth highway than it is on a rough dirt road. It is that simple. Railroads reduce the rolling resistance. They make it much easier to pull.
Much easier.
Anyhow, that much easier also has the problem. That's the problem, is that you now want to make it not easy to move because you want the wagon to stop. Now, there's a railway in the United Kingdom. I'm not going to go where it is. I mean, I could look it up, but it's not important. It's a slate railway. And technically, the railway only moves freight. I mean, it moves slate under gravity. They use horses or steam engines to pull empty wagons up to the top of the hill. But the slate goes down the hill in a bunch of little wagons because it's going downhill. That's it. And of course, it's filled with slate, which is heavy. So by gosh, those little wagons better have brakes or they're not going to get to the bottom of the hill. They're going to get to the bottom of the hill and go right into the river, right into the canal. And that's it. So brakes are I just can't emphasize how important it is to be able to stop the ready thing. Well, initially, with your average wagon, you never really worried about the brakes unless you were like going down a steep hill or something. You're trotting along at a little small trot with a horse or two horses or four horses, and you're up on your wagon with your reins, and you go, woo! And the horse stops walking, and the wagon stops. That's straightforward. That's very straightforward. I mean, I hope, have run somewhere, you know, dashed across the room, run to get to the train, and have to make pity steps to stop because you want to stop and, you know, pay your ticket or not run into the wall or something. And that's okay. Humans okay at stopping. They don't, their legs can stop them. The horse can stop them. But we're talking here again about scale problem. Railroad wagons, even one, I'm talking about from 1805, 1804, when Richard Trevithick was building his first working steam engines, high-pressure steam engines. The problem there was, we're going to need some kind of brake. Okay. They figured out that they could put the same kind of brakes they'd been using on wagons and coaches and stagecoaches and carriages, and that should do. And they found way too quickly, I mean, it's like it should have been obvious to anybody, the trains weighed more. Even those little small wagons that you could see in that picture I have provided, they're not very big. They're maybe three times the capacity of a standard wheelbarrow, maybe even only twice. But you fill that with rocks and it weighs a lot. And if you link that to another one and another one and another, you got four or five. Now you're talking about a lot of weight and you're going to need some kind of brake to stop it. And through the railway technology boom, from Richard Trevithick in the early years of the 19th century, the very earliest years, all the way through, and I mean all the way through the 19th century, right and into almost into the 20th. They mostly had this conquered by the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s, sorta. But even then, even into the 1910, 1920, the early years of the 20th century, it was not uncommon to have a railway car, whether it was a passenger coach or a freight wagon, to really be too heavy for the brakes it had. Oh, it's not saying that it didn't stop, but it might not stop in a time frame and distance that you were sort of hoping on. So I've sort of gone on there about brakes, and train brakes posed additional problems. When you had two people on a heavy wagon with two big strapping horses in front and you're carrying a load of rocks or a load of lumber and you needed to step on that brake. And quite literally, it was your put your foot up high, pushed on this lever, and it's a big lever. I'm talking a meter, 2 meter or longer lever, and it, you know, pivoted and pressed its little shoe against the brake, the wheel. You were using, the action of a lever, the advantages, if I had a lever big enough, I could move the earth. You have a big lever, and you can apply a lot of force, and even these wagons had troubles stopping. Now, you magnify that by much heavier, and I wanted to point out both people driving the wagon were sitting in the little bench seat thing up at the front, and could clearly communicate with each other. Herb, press down harder, we're not stopping! I'm stopping as hard as I can. And, you had communication. Well, when you have a train that has 1, 2, 3, 8, 10, 12 railway cars, and each of these railway cars is as long as a modern-day automobile, or maybe twice as long, it's a very long train. You can't go, yell out the back, and get them to... So what was done really quickly, this became really obvious, locomotives were equipped with two signaling devices. Now, not all locomotives in the early part of the 19th century had this, but by the mid-time of the 1840, 1850, in the United States, Canada, possibly parts of Mexico, and a few other countries, many locomotives had what was a bell. Ding, 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 a bell. And the other ones had whistles. Okay? Steam whistles. I can't make a good whistle sound. Oh, I have to go get my whistle. Anyway, the thing was, these were originally put on to try to get people who might have gathered on the railroad track to get off the track. But it became a communication device, mostly the whistle. Of all things, it was the steam whistle. And what would happen is, we're jumping to North America, the 1840s. The engine had a pretty good set of brakes. We'll talk about that more in the future. But the engine had brakes, but the coach, passenger coaches, or more likely boxcars behind you, didn't have very good brakes. And of course, at that time, the locomotive had no control over the cars other than the fact that, it was pulling them. And if it stopped, they tend to shove into it, and that tended to slow it down some. So what you'd do is you'd whistle down. There would be a whistle code, and I'm not going to say what they are. I might look that up. But they did vary by railroad and by driver. I mean, they were a little different. But you'd toot the whistle, toot, 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 a couple of times. And the brake operators on the train would go, oh my gosh, and they'd start turning the big brake wheels. You might have seen those on trains. Even today, they have those brake wheels. But in those days, it was, and sometimes you have to jump to the next car, and you would literally start applying the brakes on every single car. And the train would start to slow down. Well, the more it slowed down, the slower it got, the easier it was for the locomotive's brakes to actually stop the train. I mean, the last little shh, was... And by the way, the locomotive wasn't relying on just a handbrake. A locomotive had steam, lots of steam, and there was a little cylinder hooked up to some brake shoes, and you open a little valve, and steam would go... And the brake shoes would go wah, against the wheels. And you had lots of braking power, but only in the locomotive. Okay, you might ask, hey, wait a minute, come on. Why not use the steam brake? If the steam brakes on the locomotive are so good, why didn't you put those on the boxcars? Good point. That's a good point. There's a good reason. The longer you run a steam line, the longer a steam line is, the cooler steam gets. If steam gets cool enough, you know what you have? You've got water vapor. If you don't have water vapor, you've got hot water. If you don't have hot water, you've got warm water. if you don't have warm water, you have cold water. And if you have cold water, it's not going to make the brakes go. And worse, if you get too much cold water in that pipe, and it gets cold one day, the pipe freezes and it breaks because those pipes were all made out of iron. So steam was not a solution. Now, I think you might know the answer, but I'm not going there.
No, I'm not. I'm not going there.
That's another time. Right now, we're going to talk about the breaks between 1804 and, almost 1870. I'm talking about that period of time. And I'm sorry, I will be mostly focusing on North America, but I'm going to bring up Great Britain in just a minute, and Europe, and a few other places. Just watch me. I'm coming to it. So anyway, as I said, you had the breaks throughout the train, and you often in the old American West, and all the way up to almost the 1970s, we had what we called a caboose, the caboose at the end of the train. The caboose's brakes were pitiful. I mean, they were pitiful. But there was a place there for the conductor to sit and do his waybills. We'll talk about that someday, too. And one of the brake operators was there, and he'd get out. Mostly men. One or two women snuck into that job for a while, but that's another issue. Anyway, the poor schlob would have to get out, climb on top of the boxcar. Hopefully it was a boxcar. If it was a hopper car, that's even more miserable, because it might be empty, it might be full. And you would climb along, and they used to have actually a walkway right on top of the car. Terrible place to be. Swaying car, and you're on top of this little, and you walk along it, and you start tightening brake shoes down, and then you walk a little further. Well, walk's sort of funny way. Stagger along and hope you don't fall off to the next car and tighten that brake shoe down when you've gotten this signal. Alrighty. Well, everybody kept saying, hey, why can't we stop the train from the engine? Well, I'm going to go over just briefly two ways that this could be done. And I'm going to jump straight over to the British Isles. And what they did was, they didn't have cabooses. The British never really had what we call a caboose in North America. But they had a car that might be misunderstood at. There was a wagon at the end of a goods train. And so you had 10 or 12 cars of a goods train. There would be this funny-looking car at the back. It was probably a little bit shorter, and it clearly had windows and had a door, so it was clearly for humans to get in, and you'd see somebody get in. Well, what this was a brake van. It was a van specifically designed to stop the train. So when the engineer or the driver would go, doot, the guy back there would start tightening the brakes down. Well, this had really good brakes, and it was a very heavy van, and usually a very strong one, so that its brakes could impart enough braking force to allow the train to slow enough for the engine's brakes to stop it. And brake vans were used, gosh, I'm not gonna quote the exact date, but well through most of the 20th century. I mean, I've seen pictures on British railway videos with them in the 1930s, so I wouldn't be surprised they didn't last longer in some operations. Now, we'll also go into what the British did. The British came up with what I consider a brilliant solution to braking, and I'll save that for another day. I have to have material, you know. I've got to fill up my half hour. Anyway, let's go to North America here real quickly. And somebody said, well, one of the problems is we need to stop the train. The driver of the train needs to be able to stop the train right now. Well, one inventor, and the date was who posted the invention, was 1853. Okay, that's just halfway into the 19th century. It's only been, 49 years since the first locomotive ran. So it's not like, this is ancient time. Anyway, what the inventor did was, if you ever look at an old railway car, the brake wheels were, the wheel was horizontal, and it went straight up, and often you would see somebody standing on top of the car turning it, or out the back on the platform of a passenger car. There'd be the little platform, and there'd be the brake wheel. And more than any places, this was for passenger trains, because, boy, no kidding, people wanted safer trains when they were on them. Well, what Kramer did was he put this donut-looking shape thing, this big round thing at the base of the brake, which was a big spring. It was a big coil spring. And what it did was, is you would take the wheel and you could tighten the brakes or loosen the brakes, but this spring had a lever hooked to it to a cable or a very light chain, but usually a cable or rope that ran along the underside of the entire train. Not hanging, it was, you know, little doohickeys would keep it from drooping. Anyway, this rope went all the way down the train. Now, a passenger train might have 4, 5, or even 6 coaches. That's a long train at the time. And what the Kramer device was considered an emergency brake. The engineer could literally pull on that rope, and when he did, it would pull out little pins on all those springs, and those springs would go and would tighten all the brakes on all the cars at the same time. This was used somewhat successfully for a while. The problem was that once you applied it, it could take you considerable time and very great effort to A, get the pins back into all the brake apparatuses, and then 2 stout people to turn that brake wheel and tighten that spring back up and thereby release the brakes. It was okay as an emergency brake, but it really didn't allow you much flexibility. There was no flexibility in the operation, and, well, But still, for safety's sake, a number of railways did employ the Kramer spring brake to passenger trains to emphasize their safety. Well, let's look at another contender. Back a few years later, and my date says 1855, and that's just 2 years later, was a man named William Longbridge, and he patented a very complicated system of a chain brake. What this was a chain, and again, it's a long chain. It was linked together as cars were coupled together, so that in theory, using a apparatus, a winding apparatus, the driver or people in the locomotive could apply all the brakes on all the cars at the same time. Well, this wasn't a bad idea, but chains are notorious for a couple of problems. One, they're not, getting them tight enough to work, but not so tight as to actually make the brakes go off when you don't want them. Linking them together and unlinking them and making a link that works reliably. And of course, we're talking, again, 1855, and these links were probably iron, and if they were steel, they were not the highest grade of steel. And there were numerous problems with, you know, dirt, mud. The mechanism was very touchy about being set. It did not quite suit the bill and was another mechanical problem. Now, again, we'll look at one other. I'm going to jump real closely to one other system, and I think I'll come back to it another day because I want to. I haven't mentioned what's used today. I'm not even telling you. I'm coming back, so maybe you'll listen to me again. tricky bear. All right. The British came up with a system which they continued to use, I believe, well into the 21st century, and that was a system called vacuum brakes. Okay, what that was that you had a pipe all along the train to these big brake piston thingies. And when you applied a vacuum to one side, air pressure would push the piston quite forcibly, and that force could be hooked to linkages to hook to the brakes. The vacuum brake had two advantages. One, vacuums can't freeze, so you had no problem with water or ice or any of that. So, no, vacuum, that wasn't a problem. And the other was, because of the size of the vacuum pump and the piping, it was possible to apply the brakes, release the brakes, and then reapply the brakes in a very short time. I mean, within minutes of a heavy application, you could make another heavy application. In other words, let's say you're on a train that stopped every 5 or 10 minutes down a track to pick up or let off passengers. Well, the vacuum brake really worked very well. It wasn't as powerful as, say, the steam brake or other brakes, but it did have the advantage of being able to be used and reused. In other words, you could use it over and over again. Ah, wait a minute. Somebody out there somewhere might say, hey, Kuma, why didn't they use hydraulic brakes like my car has? Well, I will explain that in just a moment. But interesting to know that some movies, I have seen movies, where they've had the brake line on a train brake and gushes out hydraulic fluid. That is a myth! Ooh, railway legends, myths, and stories. Yes, that's a myth. No, trains do not use hydraulic brakes. Now, technically, a small piece of equipment, like a truck that's been converted to run on the rails, yes, it does use hydraulic brakes. But not locomotives and passenger cars and freight wagons. No, they don't do that. So, anyway, we've looked at a little bit about the brakes, and there was all the work on brakes was a long, and even still today, complicated process. There was not just the brake itself, but the brake shoe, the thing that would contact between the brake and the wheel. And they started off as wood, later became iron, and today they're mostly of a composite material that, well, resists wear and gives longer life. And matter of fact, on a modern American train, the crew of a train can replace a brake shoe. They usually carry spares. It's relatively simple. It's not, I never said it was fun, but it's not a complicated thing. I mean, it's literally you pull out a pin, you pull out the shoe, you drop in a new shoe, you put in the pin, you use a hammer or the end of a crowbar or something, bang, 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 and knock the pin in, and now the brake shoe has been replaced, and off you go. It's that simple. Now, of course, it is possible on a modern train to take one car and turn its brakes off so that because they're not working, and the other cars can do the job. That's one of the other things, is modern trains, the brakes work together, and any one shoe that doesn't work isn't going to hurt you none. Well, okay, I've gone on here for a while, and I will come back to this issue of stopping trains another day, because I've got a great tale about stopping a runaway train that I happen to have not been in. I was the one actually helping cause it to be a runaway train. Wasn't necessarily my fault. My fault was I wasn't on the train. I want to tell you about that. It was actually a trolley car. Anyhow, that's going to be all for right now, and we'll come back to more another time. And I hope everybody's been enjoying another episode of Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. I'll see you again sometime, and as always, we hope you see you on the train. Bye-bye.
Open VoIP.